Our guest today is Peter Renton, the chairman and co-founder of FinTech Nexus, a diversified media company providing essential connections and inspiration in the entire financial services industry. Today, expect to learn guest outreach strategies and building relationships with industry leaders, explore the SEO benefits of podcast transcriptions and their role in driving website traffic, discover the role of event preview shows in event marketing, and leveraging podcast audiences for promotional purposes. Before we begin, please remember to subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast. And if you're there, please also leave us a review. 5 stars do amazing things for the podcast. And we're going to keep bringing you all different gurus in the podcast industry to help you learn all the different ways you can use your podcast to help and grow your business. And with that, here's Peter Renton.
Peter, can you tell me the story of the oldest and most consistent podcast in the fintech space, please?
Well, thank you, Guillaume. I appreciate that. But yes, so I started podcasting back in 2013, and I'll give you a little bit of backstory how I sort of got to that point. Yeah, I had started a blog in 2010, started blogging about fintech, specifically a specific niche of fintech called peer-to-peer lending. That was what I was initially really focused on. And that kind of built up a following there, and that led into having an event. And I'd always intended to start a podcast. Well, not always. After I'd been going for about a year, so 2011, I thought I need to start a podcast because I love interviewing people, and it took me a while to get there. And then we started an event, and that took a lot of my time. But it was after the first event that we did our first fintech event was June of 2013. I said, right, now I've got to actually put some effort in and start a podcast. So I did later that year, and really was focusing on the lending space, the peer-to-peer lending space, and then the broader like online lending, what we call fintech lending today. And was the very first podcast in the space, and was able to get secure great guests right from the get-go because I really was the first person doing it.
But why? Why start a podcast?
Why start? It's a good question. I wanted to start a podcast because podcasting back then, it was starting to get some traction. So I thought it was a great way to reach people, to help to drive them to my blog, which in turn drove people to our conference, our events business. So we would do like discount codes that were only on the podcast, so we could track how many people would sign up directly from the podcast. And we were getting tens of thousands of dollars for each event coming directly through the podcast. So that kept me motivated, kept me going. And we didn't take advertising. Occasionally I would do something, but most of the time I promoted, I promoted our own events. And that was it was a revenue driver for us really from the get-go. We found that we were getting people coming to the event who had listened to the podcast.
So I love that. Obviously, there is the, hey, let's talk about fintech with great people aspect, for sure. I love that from the get-go, you had a clear business model in mind. Like, hey, let's broaden our reach, feed some traffic towards the blog, eventually capture email addresses, I guess, give discount codes to be able to track, and let's drive all these towards physical in-person event.
Yeah. Exactly, because every podcast I've done ever, it has an accompanying blog post that comes with it. Obviously, you embed the audio into the blog, and so people, I would drive people to our website, which of course had easy ways to get to pay for a ticket to go to the event or even sponsorship, and that we got a few sponsors that way for our event, and average sponsorship was over $10,000. So that was another great revenue driver, not just selling tickets. Most of the time I was focusing on selling tickets, but sometimes that would turn into a large sponsorship.
Wow. So what type of events did you host, just to get a grasp of what was happening around your podcast world? Like, what kind of events are linked to eventually your podcast? How do you fit all this together?
Yeah, so we started off with like a one day in-person event. This was back in June of 2013, and it was really for the industry, for the online lending industry. Peer-to-peer was the focus, but we extended it out beyond pure peer-to-peer just to broaden our reach into any kind of online lending operation, because not everyone had peer-to-peer who was operating online. So it was just a one-person event. But what we intended to do very early on was to take this to other countries. And I could see in my podcast that I was getting a lot of listenership in the UK, which was really the birthplace of peer-to-peer lending. And so very soon after I launched the podcast, we did our first trip to the UK, and then we ended up launching an event in 2014, November of 2014. We had our first event in London, and again, that was a profitable event that was supported again by the podcast. Because what I do, I would do a trip to London, and I'm based in Denver, Colorado, and I'd do a trip to London, bring some podcasting gear and set up in the offices of some of these big companies and record a podcast and then publish that, so I would have something for the UK listenership. And I did that very, very early on, and that helped drive ticket sales to that event in London. And then we did a similar thing in China a little bit later on. I mean, I could see that there was some listeners coming in from China. We had people asking us to come to China because China was sort of really big force in peer-to-peer lending. It was the largest peer-to-peer lending market in the world at one point. And there's a lot of people who speak English in China, and that sort of helped kind of really get the get sort of awareness of what we were doing in that country. So the great thing about podcasting is it's global. And, you know, I podcast in English, and that's something that, you know, I even found in China, I would have people coming up to me at our events saying, oh, I love your podcast. I listen to every episode. And so it really helps. The podcast really helped raise my personal profile, but at the same time, the business that we were doing had real impact.
So can you break down peer-to-peer lending for those who might not know what that is exactly, including me? I have a notion of it, but hey, I could definitely use a clear explanation.
So I mean, it's interesting. It began actually in the UK in 2004 with the launch of Zopa. Zopa is still going today. They don't really do much in the way of peer-to-peer. A lot of the original peer-to-peer lending platforms have moved on to another form of lending, just because it's very hard to scale peer-to-peer lending companies. But basically what happens is you have two sides of a marketplace. You have investors on one side and you have borrowers on another. And a borrower will just apply online for a loan. That's just an online loan application, just like any other. But what the nuance is that the borrower knows that it's not borrowing from an unnamed bank. It's not borrowing from, you know, an organization that has trillions of dollars in assets. It's borrowing from individual people, and who sort of, so what you can do is that you can invest in a slice of each loan as an investor. The minimum is usually pretty small, like $10, $20, $25, something like that. So you would invest in a $25 in there. You might do a $10,000 loan and have, you know, 20, 25, even sometimes 100 investors, depending on how it breaks out, that invest in that loan. And so what the whole premise is that you're kind of cutting out the middleman, cutting out the bank, and doing it directly from the investor to the consumer. So that's how it works. As I said, most of there's still, like, Prosper is in the US. They still do peer-to-peer lending. I still have investments in peer-to-peer lending. And that's really what got me into it from the investor side. But most of the big, like the big ones in UK have all moved on. Most of the big ones in the US moved on. China, eventually, there was a lot of fraud in peer-to-peer lending, and there's virtually nobody doing it there, even though it was the largest market in the world.
Interesting. But so as a former banker myself, I can't help but think, What about credit risk? What about calculation of interest? What about, I mean, recovering the money that you lended eventually if it ends up in like not getting back? Or how does it all work? Because you don't have one person to go and to hold accountable, right? It's like dozens of thousands of investors and borrowers as well. Or am I getting lost here?
No, it's a fair question, and it's something that came up a lot in the early days of P2P lending. That and the very early days, a lot of people didn't know what the hell they were doing. Pretty soon after you've done a few loans and they've and you see that what has performed well and what has performed badly, I would say without exception, every P2P lending platform hired somebody who typically run consumer credit at a bank. A lot of Capital One people from the credit card side. In fact, the CEO of Zopa in the UK right now is a former Capital One executive. And there's plenty of others, like all the big credit card companies, that's consumer credit. I mean, the banks sort of pulled back from personal loans, which is what the primary use case was for P2P lending. But most of the platforms within, you know, usually 2 to 3 years of their founding, once they could afford to pay these people, they would hire, you know, credit risk experts that had sometimes decades of experience working at banks.
Mm. The thing I love about this podcast is I get to learn about stuff like this, and it's absolutely amazing. That was quite a tangent, but love it. Talk to me about blog posts from podcast episodes, Peter. Why would you do that in the first place? And the reason I'm asking this is that's something I push for a lot to podcasters, my clients and others. It's like, guys, not everybody listens to podcasts. I wish they would. I wish the entire planet would listen to podcasts, but not everybody does. 77% of internet users read a blog post every month, at least. So there is value in just transforming that content. What's motivated you to go that way from a very early stage?
Well, yeah, keep in mind that the blog predated the podcast. So I had a readership. I mean, I had something that, you know, I would get, well, some of my blog posts would get often, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 views in the week or two after I publish. So that, it, to me, it was just a no-brainer. And what I did also was the first 19 podcasts, I did not do transcriptions, but it's from podcast number 20, and I'm up to 482 right now as we're recording this. But from podcast number 20 onwards, I did transcriptions. And originally it was done with just people transcribing it. There was no real AI tools back then to do it. So I actually hired people. I had a transcriber in the Philippines who I found through an early editor that I was using, and she would transcribe my podcasts, and then so the transcription would go up with the blog post. Great for long tail SEO, but also great for people who like to read rather than listen. Like I still to this day, in fact, I was just talking to the CEO of one of the major fintech lenders here just a couple of months ago, and he was saying that, yeah, I was reading your podcast the other day, and so they're
what?
Like there are I still do transcriptions, obviously, and so he says, yeah, I like to read, and he consumes my podcast via transcription, and so there's plenty of people who do that. And the reason I started, and I think if you're starting a podcast, you should start a blog already, because if I feel like it's another way to attract people. You can get the you know, those people who are searching around online. It's, you know, they might find your podcast on, you know, Spotify or Apple Podcasts or something. But if you can get more people if you have a blog and you're writing articles. Like I've been podcasting. Originally, I was podcasting every other week. I've been doing it once a week now for probably 7-8 years now. I've been doing it once a week, but originally it was every other week. But I was publishing articles every day, and it's just when I would go to publish the podcast, that would be my article for that day. It would be the podcast. Obviously, I would kind of do a little intro. I'd hit on some of the sort of talking points that we covered in the podcast and try and sort of, yeah, sell the episode, convince people to go listen to it. And you know, we get, to this day, we still get a lot of people, like those blog posts that accompany the podcast are often, in fact, always, they are, there's usually, if I look at the top 10 blog posts for the month, there's always one or two podcasts in there that are the most viewed posts each month. So it's a great way to kind of get more listeners and get more readers and just get your name out there more.
100%. So Peter, you're the very first person who tells me about not even a positive feedback, a feedback at all about a transcript posted on a website. I'm like, the way I approach this is, how many times did you Google something? Like, did you search for something on Google and Google proposed you a transcript of a podcast or a video? Very rarely, right? If at all, because that doesn't rank well in SEO. Yes, it's very keywords rich, but it's not like structured in a proper manner. And at the end of the day, I was convinced that very few people would read to a transcript. An article, that's a whole different story. But you had people reaching out to you saying, hey, I actually want to get the full experience of the podcast just reading it, and it probably go faster. Is that what it is?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are people, I mean, I'm not one of them, so I've always preferred to consume podcasts. In fact, when I'm working out on my exercise bike or going for a walk or something, I'm pretty much always am listening to podcasts as I do that. You know, driving around in the car on weekends, often that as well. But I consume a lot of podcasts. I probably have about 50 that are in my library right now. And I obviously don't listen to everything that everyone produces, but I at least glance at everything everyone produces to see whether it's something that I'm interested in. But as far as transcripts, I think, it's these days, I mean, I have an AI, I use Otter, right? Otter AI, otter.ai. Feed your audio file in there. It spits out a transcription. It's pretty good. You still, it's not quite ready to publish out of the box. I have an assistant who goes through and corrects the errors that it does. But it's not very expensive. It's easy to do. And the great thing is, like I do typically 30 to 35 minute podcasts, depending on how fast the person talks. That can be anywhere from 5,000 to 7,500 words, and those words go into your website, and what it's great for is long tail searches that, you know, and obviously there's, when you're podcasting about a particular topic, there's going to be a lot of the keywords that come up in that conversation again and again. So it's, to write a 5,000 to 7,500, 500 word blog post would take hours and hours of, you know, probably a whole day, maybe 2 days. But for me, I've been doing this a lot. I, you know, it takes me from the time I start to publish the podcast to the time it's done is usually an hour and 15 minutes if it's a bit longer podcast. And I listen to my show completely from start to finish. And, because I want to make sure before I send it out to the world that it sounds good, everything is good, and there's not an error or something that I need to fix. But I will listen to it, and that's when I will create my notes and publish the blog post as I'm listening to it. But the transcription, I just think it's a no-brainer. It's so good for SEO that Google comes and looks at your site and goes, oh wow, there's a 5,000 word article on this site. That's something that it likes to suck up, and it likes to, you know, then you'll be presented in many, many more Google results. Once you've done now, like I'm almost up to 500 podcasts. I mean, that's millions upon billions of words that are just from podcast transcriptions that are on the site.
That makes lots of sense. What's the hardest problem you have faced with the podcast? I'm asking this because you're in a super competitive niche now. You have 500 plus episodes, or getting there?
Almost 500.
Yeah. You've been in activity for like a decade. You've seen lots of stuff, so I cannot even begin to fathom how much things you've like learned, people you've discussed with. What's the hardest problem you had to solve with your podcast?
Well, I would say there's been a couple of things. One is that, you know, particularly in the early days, you've got to be consistent. I feel like that's the hardest problem back then was I had a lot to do and it was like, oh my God, I've got to, yeah, we were understaffed and it became, I've always enjoyed the podcast, so it wasn't a burden to do it, but it was a time drain where, you know, back when I didn't have an assistant or anything, I was just doing 100% everything myself. Apart from the, I mean, I had someone who would do editing, I had someone who did the transcription, but I would doing everything myself and just finding the time to do it and being committed. And it was easy that it would have been so easy to say, oh, I'm too busy. I'm doing, building this conference business. Now that's taking up so much of my time. I think that was something that, particularly in the early days when, you know, I'd only had, you know, 30, 40 episodes under my belt and it would have been easy just to let it slowly slide away and just say, oh, I'm like, too busy this week, I'll do it next week, whatever. But so overcoming that was important. Then I think today, I mean, really the thing that's, I think, most hard today is right now, when I started, I was by myself. There was no competition. Now I look at fintech podcasts, and so I've broadened from beyond just P2P lending and beyond online lending to a broader fintech, fintech focus. So, you know, I still probably do about half my shows have something to do with lending, but half don't, and they do other areas of fintech such as payments, the software infrastructure, all kinds of, you know, fraud, different types of areas of fintech that now I focus on. And when I look at the competition, I mean, there's probably 50 good fintech podcasts out there now. So that's a really hard problem to kind of keep your name out there. And so how I'm combating that problem is really focusing on guest quality. And so making sure, I mean, I've got an advantage because I've been doing this so long that I've had pretty much every fintech CEO. I've still got two that I'm working on, and I've been working on for a year now, and I'd hope to get them on this year, but I'm still working on, but, you know, really focusing on quality of guests. And as when you become a fairly well-known podcaster, I get on average probably, it's 4 or 5 requests a day I get for people who want to be on the podcast. And sometimes it's 10. I'll get 10 emails in a day, mainly from PR agencies, from people be on. And so most of those I say no to. Very occasionally I'll see someone that's on my list and say, all right, I'll do that. But the thing is, when it becomes more competitive, you've got to focus on quality, because that's what you, if you just kind of just dial it in and don't really put as much effort into it, then is you're just going to fade away, and you're going to see your listener numbers start to decline, and it's hard to kind of be on top of your game when it's a really competitive market.
100%. Do you want to spoil a bit spoiler alerts? Who are you trying to onboard as a guest, Peter? Can you say?
Okay, I'm happy to share, because these people have both spoken in our events over the years, but one is the CEO of Chime, Chris Britt. Chime is the largest digital bank in the US. Massive number. I think it's like 20 plus million customers that they have. So I've a PR agency, yes, he's going to come on. They say he's going to come on, but just timing is right. It's got to be right. So then the CEO of Plaid, Zach Perrett, he's another one that's spoken at our events, but never been on the show. I've had pretty much every other fintech CEO, all of the public companies, they've all been on the show. trying to get those two.
That's such a sentence to say. I had all the fintech CEOs of publicly traded companies on the show. Boom. Mic drop. No pun intended. Tell me a bit.
Well, I haven't had them on the show before they were public. And that's why we've been around a long time. You know, I would first connect with these people when they had 10 employees, and I'd get to know them, and then we'd talk, we'd have a beer at an event, and then suddenly they've got, you know, 2,000 employees and they're a public company, but I still have that personal relationship, so that really helps.
100%. 100%. No, that's such an amazing tool to connect with people, the podcast. Tell me a bit about those events, Peter, and your business behind, I mean, not necessarily behind the podcast, but what you do, quote unquote, for a living. What's your business? So right now you're the co-founder and chairman of FinTech Nexus, but throughout the life of your podcast, which has, well, gone over your time at certain companies, what's your kind of business model and approach when you're like going on a podcast interview and overall with your, yeah, just your, you know, your entrepreneur's life?
Sure. Sure. So, well, I can sort of explain a little bit about how the history of the business has evolved. And I started off as a blogger. My business model was affiliate sales to some of the to the major players in the market. That was very early on. And then the business model kind of, I did some advertising as well on the blog. Then once I started the events business, that was, I had no idea the how one profitable events can be and how much revenue they can generate. And so most of my time went into the events business. As I said, the podcast was just another lead generation tool for the events business. That really, over the years, yeah, just we would always have like an event preview show on the podcast. I started doing that, I think it was like right at the beginning, like in 2014, we would do one show that was really a half hour ad for our event, but it would go through what people were coming to the event, what they would expect and that sort of thing. So it was very much focused around the event. Now, June of 2023. So, just last year, we sold our events business and we became a digital media company. Now, digital media, basically that entails doing webinars, doing white papers, doing advertising, email blasts, things that where you can kind of get your name out digitally. We have a very large and responsive customer base, a large email list. So when we sold the events business, and that kind of came, we had the pandemic, obviously. That's when we launched the digital media business, because in the pandemic, our business was deemed illegal. We could not host events, so we had to do something. And so we really went all in on digital media, thinking that we would get back to events and the digital media would just go away. But what happened was that while we went back to our events business in 2022, which was our best year ever, we had a phenomenal year of sort of coming back from the pandemic. And then we sold in 2023. But the thing that was interesting is the digital media, the webinars and the white papers and the things that people got used to doing in the pandemic, it continued post-pandemic. And to this day, we still host a webinar, average one to two a week, where we are, where people pay us, it's not cheap. This is a good sort of revenue generator for us. And so we've now kind of become this digital media company. And the great thing about a webinar is that it's basically a podcast with lots of people on it. I mean, we have, my podcast is called FinTech One-on-One. So it's pretty much always just a one-on-one interview. But with a webinar, it's typically, I do most of the interviews there, and I'm interviewing usually, two, three or four people I'll be interviewing. And, when you've done a few podcasts, it really helps. Yeah, I can run a webinar now just as easy as I can run a podcast. And you can charge money for webinars, and we just do ours on Zoom, and it works. It's a great product. Everyone likes it. People like to get educated for free. You come and we have good guests on, good companies that they can learn from. And then the sponsor gets all the email addresses of the people who register for the webinar. And it's a good exchange. Everyone understands it. And it continues to perform well. So if you're a podcaster, there's a potential revenue source there to just launch webinars and sell sponsorship to them. And it's a great, it's not that much of a leap. And it's easier than you might think to do that. So that's kind of I think digital media in general goes well with podcasting.
Peter, I'm actually super interested into diving into the economics of this. So, I mean, you don't have to give numbers. You can if you want, But how, I want to walk through the economics of an in-person event and the economics of those webinars. In-person event, how does it work exactly? I jumped into this world back in September 2023 when I attended to the first in-person event of my life. It was in corporate treasury in finance. It's a niche in finance. And it's like, you have that those huge sponsors. So you have everybody, like everybody that has a stand pays to have the right to have a stand there. But you also have like ticket fees. And then you have sponsors and you have events around it. Like, what are the economics of an in-person event in a niche like fintech, but like it can be broader as well?
Sure. So the economics, there's two main revenue drivers. There's the ticket sales and there's sponsorship. Now, we include exhibitors in the sponsorship. Not everyone wants to have a booth. Some companies differentiate between exhibitors and sponsors. We would lump them all in together. So it was really two types of attendees, shall we say. And sponsors get free tickets to the event. That's part of their package typically. But I can tell you, like, you know, the event, we would typically sell our tickets were $3,000 full price. Now, again, there were discount codes you could find relatively easily. Like on my podcast, there would be always a discount code that we would give that was usually 15% off. And we would sell, when you start selling the event, typically you start selling the event at least 6 months out, preferably 9 months out. You would start selling tickets to the event. And you have an early bird price. And so you'd have an early bird, which is usually, yeah, sometimes, you know, 25 or even 40, up to 40% off the full retail price. And then the tickets would slowly get more expensive the closer you get to the event. So that's one thing, one part of it. And the other part is the booths. You know, basically you're selling land. You're selling a 10 by 10 booth. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're selling real 10 by 10 booth that might cost you as an event organizer, it might cost you $500 for that 10 by 10 booth, depending on where you're doing it. But you can sell that for, you know, I think our retail price for our booths was $15,000. So you can see that it's quite profitable to do that. And then there's other things you can do, like we would have track sponsors. So we'd have multiple tracks of content within the event, and then we would sell a track sponsorship that would I think the retail price for those were like $50,000, and it was for a full day of content, and they would get one of their executives to speak on the opening session of the track. It was just one of the things that we offered. The cost of doing that was, you know, signage, you know, less than $1,000. We'd sell for $50,000. So you get to see how things can be quite profitable. Now, sometimes you'll see big banners, like physical printed banners at events often. They cost quite a bit of money, and we wouldn't get as much profit margin on those. But then we'd have like TV set up with some sponsors who just want their banner on a TV. Again, you have to sort of rent the TV and do that. So there's lots of different ways, we would call it inventory. There's lots of different inventory to sell. But when it came down to it, we would have probably, it usually was around 60% revenue from sponsors and 40% from ticket sales. And then the gross margins are very, very good. And it's, you know, the events business, you know, I never intended to get into the events business. I fell into it because I had an online following and people said, let's start an event. Let's meet together in person. And I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But, you find people who do know what they're doing. And, you know, to this day, like the president of our event, of our business, Joy Schwartz, came to us with really deep events experience. And before we hired her, we were a mess. We didn't know what the hell we were doing, and things were last minute. We'd have employees pulling all nighters the night before an event because we weren't ready. And so she whipped us into shape and hired a team, and really we became a professional outfit once she kind of got involved. But that's the events business. Now, webinars are very simple. You need a Zoom subscription, or you can use other. You can use there's Bright Talk and other platforms as well. And Yeah, you need an email list. That's the thing. So when someone someone wants to sponsor a webinar, they say we guarantee them 100 names, 100 email addresses. Usually we deliver far in excess of that, sometimes 200, 300, even 400 names sometimes, where they would get the name and email address. You know, it's free to the attendees. Now the retail price for a webinar is $25,000. And again, you guaranteed 100 leads, so it's $250 a lead. Now, if you wanted to buy a webinar and an email blast we would discount it, and most people would buy a package, and not few people. Very occasionally, someone would just buy a standalone webinar. Most time, it was a package, things that they buy, and so you get a little cheaper than that. But again, digital media, it's got pretty good profit margins as well, because it's your own time, and then you've got to sometimes it's a very niche topic, and it's hard to get those 100 names. So we would do paid ads on LinkedIn, sometimes even Facebook or Instagram to get the 100 names that we promise people. That happens probably 10 to 15% of the time, where we've got to really work hard to get the 100. Most of the time, we've got a large database that it's pretty easy to get those names to sign up.
So 100 leads, so 100 email addresses, 25,000. That's $250 a lead, if my math is correct. Yeah, that's insane. So the reason I'm asking is because our first podcast is about corporate treasury. We have grown an email list of 900 email addresses now. We don't know what to do. We don't know what the economic, the business model behind this podcast is. We tried sponsorship. It works. It's not substantial. And we're like, maybe we should look into webinars. I had no clue of the economics of webinars. And that sounds insane.
Well, we didn't charge $25,000 at the start, let me tell you. Yeah, I think we started at 10. I can't remember. Because we started doing webinars before the pandemic, when people would just come to us and say, hey, can you host a webinar for us? And we go, sure, we can do that. And so we didn't really know what to charge. And so we just threw out a number, and that was what we charged. And then it became, as during the pandemic, it was our main source of revenue. So we upped our prices, and we worked our butt off to really deliver value for the sponsors. And we've had many, many sponsors that come back. We've had some that have been doing two or three a year since 2020. And they continue to come back because it works for them. They get leads, and they might get 100 leads, and they'll convert five or six new clients, and that'll generate $200,000 of revenue for them. So they think, oh man, this is a good deal. So they'll come back and keep doing it.
100%. And so that's per, because you said you have 3-4 guests per webinars. So is that per guest that you make this retail price, or is it the whole package?
No, it's the whole package. So the way a webinar works is you have a sponsor who says, we want to do a webinar. Oftentimes, like they will always have, well, not always, but 90% of the time, 95% of the time, they want to have one of their executives be a speaker on the webinar. And so they will then, sometimes they have a very good idea about who else they want to have speak. Sometimes they say, I don't really know. You organize the speakers for us, and we will do that. We've got a very good speaker database because of all the events we've done over the years and all the webinars we've done as well. Yeah, we've got well over 1,500 speakers that have spoken for us over the years. So that's they pay for the package, and it doesn't really matter how many speakers there are. It's driven by the sponsor. They may say, we want our executive and one of our customers to come along, and then we want you to organize somebody else. And so there's three speakers, and I'll organize the third speaker. Sometimes, like right now, we've got one where there's I'm trying to find two speakers. They want to get a traditional bank and a fintech to come. So I've done a bunch of invitations just yesterday, and waiting to hear back from who's available and able to do it.
Wow, I love that. Now, I'm about to pitch you an idea here, Peter, that we might have to cut off. Oh my God, that's such a way to build tension. Probably not going to cut off. But so Now you have those tools, right? Namely StreamYard, Restream, and I'm sure there are other apps out there where you can upload an edited episode, but then schedule a whole campaign to say, hey, who's the guest? Okay, guest, say John something. John, we are going to record this episode, not online, offline. We are going to edit it, produce it. Then we're going to put it in one of those platforms, and we're going to link your social media platforms to your social media channels to this platform, and we're going to link ours as well. There's going to be two things that are going to get out of this platform. The first one is a kind of announcement, like, hey, webinar or like live episodes that day at that time, register for it. And then at that very specific date, the episode goes live in the way of a webinar on the guests' social media platforms and the whole social media platforms that you had to register for. So you don't even have to go through the hustle of live webinar, but you get the benefit from it. Is there a business opportunity here?
Funny you should say that, because we did that exact thing.
Oh, spoiler alert.
During the pandemic, you know, keep in mind we were our survival was a threat. We could not only were we not generating income, we had huge numbers of refund requests because we were not putting on the event. More refund requests than we had cash in the bank at one point in time. So we were technically insolvent during the pandemic. So what we would do is we would sort of soak up this refund request money by offering them webinars. And we also back then said, how about we put an exec on our podcast, and that's going to be, we did a series averages. Yeah. We would charge $10,000 to $15,000 for having a guest appear on the podcast. Again, I don't recommend that as sort of a business model unless you have a really well-established podcast. We did it, and we occasionally still do it to this day because I have so many people wanting to be on my podcast, and I only record once a week, so I can only do 50 guests a year, and there's probably 500 guests right now that could all deserve to be on the podcast because the industry has grown so much. So we will say from time to time, okay, the company says, I really want to be on the podcast. Says, well, I'm sorry, you just can't be on. We have too many other guests we want to get on. And so that's what I said. We if you want to pay us money, we will get you on. So that probably during the pandemic, I was doing this regularly. Probably every fifth episode was a paid episode, and I did not make that transparent at the time. I felt like it was something I'd struggled with, but as we were in survival mode, but my point is, I wanted to make the quality of the guest and the quality episode indistinguishable from everything else. So. So I said, look, you can't put your junior sales guy on my podcast. No, that's not going to happen. But if you want to do your CFO or your CEO or one of the co-founders or whatever, then yes, we'll do that. So over the history of the podcast, I've probably done, it's been, you know, probably 30 paid episodes.
Okay.
And I challenge anyone to discover which ones they are, because it's
accepted.
Yeah, it's not easy to tell. And the quality is indistinguishable. And that's kind of why I never made a big deal out of it, because I said, right, this is just, I'm going to really make sure that everything is exactly the same as my regular shows. Now, I said, I that would never have happened but for the pandemic. And by the pandemic, you know, I'd been podcasting for, you know, 6.5 years by that stage and had a really good history, and it became something that was of value. And so we also did the webinars for we ended up doing, selling, between webinars and sponsors, well over $1 million worth of inventory. So that were refund requests. So we ended up not having to refund over $1 million because we soaked it all up with this digital inventory. And that was the launch of our digital media business, really.
Talking about lean and agile and like well, not fake it until you make it, but like survival mode and like figuring out a solution. What a crazy story. How much do you think, I'm going to put you on the spot here, Peter. How much do you think a lead is worth? Like, how much is an email address worth when it comes to webinars? Like, so 250 per leads, at least. Well, the more the leads, the better. But you have a very specific niche. You have the fintech niche. There is, well, especially at a certain time, and it's going to come back for sure, there is like lots of money into this space. If I take completely randomly the corporate treasury industry, how much do you think a lead is worth? Like if I organize a webinar, I'm saying, hey guys, okay, come on my show. We're going to use one of these platforms. It's a sponsored episode, so you're going to have to pay for it, but then it's going to be restreamed and all the email addresses that we collect from that are yours. And also the people, for instance, who have subscribed to our email list or to our free ebook on our website that end up in this webinar, you're going to get access to. How do you quantify and estimate the value of a lead then? Do you start low and then you ramp up, or what's the thought process?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think it depends on the market you're in. You're in corporate treasury, that's dealing with, you know, larger companies that have budgets. I wouldn't start low for those kinds of people, because if you start low there, they'll think it's not worth their time. I would start high. But if you were doing a segment where the product is a $50 product, then you have to start low because there's not enough economics there. Yeah, we deal in the B2B space. And that, you know, it doesn't make sense for any of the business to consumer fintechs to come advertise or promote on our show. But it's, you know, the B2B segment, and you know, a lot of our companies there, you know, they're doing $100,000 you know, projects, they're doing $1 million projects. So for them, you know, it all works out to economics. The people that are coming two or three times a year, they obviously are realizing that this is a highly profitable thing for them. So that's what you need to be. So, I mean, it depends on you know, what you've got to do. If you have a relatively small email list, so our active email list is completely segmented, is over 40,000 names. We have an additional like 90,000 names that is unsegmented, like we don't know anything about them other than their email address. So we have well over 100,000 names that we can email to, and so it's relatively easy for us to get to these guaranteed 100 names. But again, occasionally we'll spend money to top up the, we might only get to 60 names from our lists, and then we have to use paid advertising. But I think, you know, like $250 a lead, that's probably I don't know if the industry can bear much higher than that, from our perspective. And oftentimes it's most of the time it's less than that, because they're buying a webinar and, you know, and an email blast, and they're buying it together. So the webinar itself might only be $15,000, so $150 a lead, when it's bought as part of a package. But I would encourage. I always think it's a lot easier. It's scarier, but easier to price high at the start, and then you can discount, and you might go out and say, right, here's the price. It's $10,000 for a webinar, and you might get no interest at all. So then you can say, right, for a limited time, we're having a special 50% off sale, $5,000 for a webinar, and then you might get some bites on that. And you've still got your 10,000 marker. That's the retail price. You may never charge $10,000, but that's the retail price, and you can discount it from there. And you can be, you can just, once you've done it a few times, you'll get an idea of what the market will bear.
Peter, that's an absolute masterpiece. Wow, man, that's insane. No, but so that's what I want this podcast gurus to be about. It's like the world of podcasts, but how to generate revenues with it. Now, there is no secret sauce. There is, like, as you said earlier, there is tons of work behind it. Well, webinar is a specific thing, but there is, you still need to, hey, sell the stuff, get the emails, eventually do some ads. Like, it's not easy money. Like, that's a clear path. Anybody listening to us right now that has a minimum of an audience in the B2B space has a business opportunity here. Like, just launch it, see what it gives, try it. I'm definitely going to try for Corporate Treasury 101. Who knows? Peter, the question we ask at the end of every episode, and it's funny because you said earlier that you had at least 50 in mind, is top three podcasts. What are the top three podcasts that you can think of that you're listening to that you will recommend our audience and myself to listen to?
Okay.
Cannot be FinTech 101.
Yeah, well, obviously that's, I highly recommend that one. But no, I tell you right now that from the FinTech space, there's several I listen to. I like the FinTech Takes with Alex Johnson. He's one of the smartest people in FinTech and has a really an excellent podcast. FinTech Blueprint, Lex Sokolin. He's another one of the brilliant minds in FinTech. And then, you know, there's a bunch of others like This Week in FinTech. I've got a great series right now. They interviewed me as well, but of doing all of the OGs of FinTech. And this is a series that's been going on for several months, this series. And it's fantastic just getting to hear all the different people that they've interviewed. And then just one other thing I do, I listen to an economics podcast called Marketplace. It's actually a national public radio show here in the US. And that's, I like to sort of be on top of economics, and that's it's a daily show. And I will often listen to that to get I know what's going on in the economy.
So that's three FinTech podcasts and yep. one economics. What do you yep. listen for fun? Do you listen to any podcasts for fun?
You know, I do. I listen to This American Life, which is an NPR show that is, I absolutely love that show. It's in-depth interviews, and they have interesting topics that are sometimes out there. That's something that I do that comes out on the weekend. So another show I like to listen to, it's a comedy show, is Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It's an NPR show that comes out on the weekends as well, and it's a lot of fun. And apart from that, I listen, if I'm in the mood for, if I'm not in the mood to listen to a business podcast, a FinTech podcast, I'll typically listen to music. So I most of the time I'm listening to podcasts. It is something to do with FinTech or the economy.
Yeah. Makes absolute sense. Peter, thank you so much for coming on the show. It was an absolute masterpiece. I learned so much. I loved it. So thank you so much.
My pleasure, Guillaume. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the B2B Podcast Stories. We hope you enjoyed the show. And if you did, please don't forget to hit subscribe and check us out at ghamarketing.com. Have a great day.